Good morning, 7:42 here on the Mighty 690, and we are joined by the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. Joining us, we have Jesse Gilmore and Wendy Powell. Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
So we have a couple of events coming up. Jesse, you got one to start us off.
Yep, it is the first Wednesday of the month. Hard to believe we're already in March.
Know.
But that means that we've got a Garden Hour webinar today from noon to 1. This month's topic is going to be on houseplants and what you can do to keep the plants in your interior environment healthy and happy. You can register for that online if you haven't registered for any of the Garden Hours in the past. Or if you have, you can join us at noon to learn more about houseplants.
Sure. No, that sounds great. It's going to be a good one and something still timely for this time of year.
Yep. Hopefully we'll be getting more sunlight here in a little bit, but there are things to keep in mind when dealing with houseplants related to sunlight during the winter months.
Oh, sure. I mean, we're talking different angles and that sort of thing. So, I mean, I would think that there's a chance that you could burn or, you know, with that steep angle kind of coming in, that could be actually a little bit too much sun sometimes.
Yep. Orientation of windows, heating vents, and things like that.
Drying the soil out.
There's a lot of factors that go into houseplants, which is kind of counterintuitive because
sure.
It seems like, you know, they're indoors, there's less to worry about. Not necessarily.
No, I think you're right on that. So, very good. And, Wendy, you also have an event coming up even tonight, right?
Yes, I've got a big event coming up tonight. Animal Health Day is this evening. We do a trade show, and speakers are coming in. Our speaker tonight's going to talk about genetic improvement of the cattle herd. And our trade show tonight features several area businesses. So I would like to go through that list and give them a shout out. They support the program. They provide funds to cover the meal and the facility rental. So we appreciate their support. Caney Agri Services out of Caney, Bartlett Co-op, Coco Ross. Coco Ross is a new sponsor this year. They're coming out of Manhattan. That'll be fun. Coffeeville Feed and Farm Supply, Coffeeville Stockyards, Community National Bank, Corner Post Crop Insurance, Farm Talk, First Oak Bank, Frontier Farm Credit, L2 Realty, McCabe Genetics, Montgomery County Conservation District, Montgomery County Farm Bureau, Midwest Land Group, Muller Construction, Prairie Land Partners, Roman's Outdoor Power, SEK Genetics, Weaver Equine Dentistry, and Zoetis. So we've got a great list of sponsors for the trade show, and if folks want to come in and talk to those trade show vendors, the doors will open at 5:30. We're planning to get the program started at 6. If you did not RSVP by Monday, I'm sorry, but I can't guarantee you a meal, but there will probably be room for you to come through and talk to the vendors. So definitely, if you have any questions, give me a call at the Independence office today, 620-332-2690.
Okay, well, that's going to be great. Good time there in Independence, and sounds like like you said, a pretty big event, and lots of sponsors that we recognize from the year on KGGF and then that sort of thing. So that is really great. And of course, we always like to thank sponsors on that sort
yes.
of thing. So you're also going to be touching on this a little bit during your presentation tonight, but kind of a preview here for the folks who are able to go. Kansas fence law.
Yeah, so there's a lot of rumors, misconceptions out there about how Kansas fence law works, and I've even heard that Kansas doesn't have a fence law, and that's not entirely true actually at all. So the first thing that people consider whenever we talk about fence laws is which part is mine to maintain. So when you have a property fence, a lot of folks will go to the right-hand rule, which means the two property owners on each side of the fence will meet in the middle of the fence on their sides of their fence, and each will put their right hand up, and that's their side of the fence to maintain. So the right hand rule is you meet in the middle, and the fence to your right is yours to maintain.
Okay.
Well, in actuality, that is not the Kansas law.
Interesting.
It is not the Kansas law, because when you meet in the middle of the fence, and to one direction is a creek and one direction is no trees or any barriers, that's not hardly fair.
No.
So Kansas law actually says equal shares. So that means splitting the labor, splitting the materials equally. And a lot of times in our neck of the woods, it works out to where one party might supply the materials and the other does the labor, which is fine. Yeah. If that's what's agreeable to the two landowners, that's fine. Equal shares is what works for you guys. And if the right-hand rule works for both of you, that's fine. But just know that the law says equal shares.
Okay, that's good to know.
And if folks have written agreements that go along with that division of maintenance, then that written agreement can become part of the land record. So it can be tied to the deed for anybody that comes later with ownership on those roads.
Sure. I have a couple of questions. First, do you ever have any fence law issues when there's more than two landowners? Are there fence law situations where potentially three or more landowners all have adjacent property with fences on it? And how would you manage that? And my second question is leased property. Does fence law vary for leased property as opposed to owned property?
Okay, so I'm going to take the second one first because it's easier. So on leased property, the rules still apply. Whoever the operator is, they just need to work with the landowner, and that should be something that's written into their lease. Whoever's maintaining the fence on behalf of the landowner, or if it's the landowner themselves, that's part of the lease. So the neighbor, it doesn't matter if they work with the lessee or the landowner, it's still equal shares, whoever that representative might be. On your other question, more than one landowner. So we're talking about kind of a two-dimensional system right here. So more than one landowner, I would hope in one tract of land, they would have a partnership or some sort of trust, and they would act as one entity. Mm-hmm. In the situation of like a T or a corner, that could get a little bit more sketchy, but they just need to have really good communication. And if there's a problem, which I'm glad you brought that up, in Kansas, our fence viewers are our county commissioners. So anytime there is a dispute about a fence, whether that's whose part it is to maintain, if the fence is a legal fence or not, where the boundary line is versus the fence line, all of those disputes go to the county commissioner. And the county commissioner, their ruling is written, final, and tied to the deed. So they have a whole lot more power than what a lot of folks realize when it comes to fencing. So that's why it's best to handle that locally if you can. So disputes are handled from the county commissioners. There's lots of other issues that can arise. I mentioned fence line versus boundary line.
Sure.
This is one of those gray areas, because if a fence line is not on the property line, it's really expensive to move it. I mean, it takes a lot of money to put up a fence. And if somebody's been using this area that might not be theirs legally, if they've been using it for 15 years, there's a couple of different rulings in Kansas that make it theirs.
Wow. Yeah.
So it just kind of reverts to the person using it, unless the rightful owner is going to actually do something about it within 15 years.
Well, I hate to say it, but not in Kansas. It was an Arizona thing. I know stories about people who move the fence every 15 years just to creep onto government land, actually, in that case. But not that that's a good idea, but I know it's happening.
Don't do that.
Wow.
Don't do that, but I know it's happening.
That's creative. Yeah. A couple of other things to be aware of. If livestock escape a fence, the fence is known to be faulty, livestock have been escaping for ages or whatever.
That's a challenge for some of them.
Yeah. Then the animal owner, the livestock owner, is responsible for damages. So here in Kansas, you have to be proven negligent. So if your animals have been getting out for ages, then it's easy enough to prove that you're negligent. But in most cases, property line or perimeter fencing is good. And animals stay where they're supposed to, which means it's a little bit more difficult to prove that negligence. And so damages and liability is not on the livestock owner. There's lots of... I've got several slides to go through tonight, so I'm really excited to present these details.
It's going
to
be a really good presentation.
Yeah. I've got information on what makes a legal fence. Barbed wire has to be at least 3 wires. There's specifications on the spacing of those wires being off the ground and from each other. So regulations there. Electric fencing, that is... It can be legal in Kansas. The county commissioners can delegalize it.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know if delegalize is the word. If that's I might have made that up.
Yeah, we know what you mean.
So across Kansas, county commissioners do have that authority to say, nope, we're not accepting electric fence. It's not legal.
Interesting. What would be their reasoning for that, I wonder?
Bad experiences, okay. I would guess. Yeah. Uh-huh. And we're talking perimeter fencing.
Okay.
You know, perimeter fencing. So not interior fencing. With all of these things that I've talked about today, interior fencing goes out the window.
Sure.
We're only talking perimeters.
And this applies specifically to pasture that livestock are going to be in, correct?
No, this applies to
fences.
Anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter that livestock are not going to be present. The fence law is the fence law.
Sure. Yeah. Kansas is a fence-in state, which means you're not allowed to let your animals or any critter just roam around. You have to fence them in. And Kansas is an equal shares state. So both sides of the property line, both of those landowners are responsible for maintaining that fence. And there's rules about, you know, if somebody chooses not to participate in their share of maintenance or building, then there's repercussions. So lots of fine details.
Okay, and this is really going to get in the weeds, but we're right near Oklahoma. What about those people who have a boundary property with the state line, you know?
Yeah.
Good grief. I mean, any idea how that would work?
Well, I was reading through some of the regulations about if the fence is on the county line.
Okay, uh-huh.
Okay, so let's take it down one level of jurisdiction here. The county line, the landowner or whoever can put the fence line in with whoever has the lower regulations.
Oh, okay. Sure.
So if Labette County, and I have no idea if this is true,
yeah.
County A requires a 5-wire barbed wire fence and County B requires 4, then on the county line, it can be a 4.
That seems reasonable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So on a state line, I would encourage folks to just check their facts. OSU Extension probably has some really great resources on fence laws down there. So if it is an issue, I would just ask.
Yeah, not going to apply to very many people, but there are probably some people out there who are in that boat.
Yes, in our neck of the woods, there for sure is.
Absolutely. So what else? We've got a couple minutes here to wrap up. I mean, the other thing we see is, and this is an important one, is like highway fences. You know, we always hope to have the fence along there, but every couple weeks it seems like we hear a call that, hey, some cattle out in the road or something like that. Something's happened.
I almost hit one on US 69 in Pittsburgh.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
So that cow was traveling quite a ways.
Good grief.
Yeah. So here in Kansas, the Kansas Department of Transportation, KDOT, is charged with keeping the highways reasonably safe. So this is a non-delegable duty. That's a $10 word for you this morning. They can't delegate it, is essentially what this means. They cannot delegate this duty. It's their job to make for sure the highways are reasonably safe. And that includes land that's not used for grazing. So cropland, anything. Fallow fields, it doesn't matter. So it's been a tradition that landowners just maintain their fences because of the value of their animals versus them getting hit by a car. But it is the highways department's job to take care of that. And I won't get down into all the different situations that this can run into. Railroads follow this same protocol, but there are procedures for landowners to follow if they've got issues. Give me a holler, and I'll be happy to direct you the direction you need to go.
Sure. So, yeah, if people do need to get a hold of you, if they have questions on fences, what's the best way to get in contact?
Yeah, give me a call at the Altamont office. That phone number is 620-784-5337.
And then a reminder, once again, for the event you have tonight, RSVP has passed for that, but you can even still come if you just want to kind of sit in on it.
Yeah.
Date to time and everything for that.
So the doors will open at 5:30, and the program will start at 6:30. So we have about an hour to get through networking with the trade show vendors. And that is at the Civic Center in Independence.
Okay, good deal, Wendy. That's going to be a really good event. So just judging from some of the pictures, you got some funny pictures in here. I mean, people are going to get a kick out of just some of the pictures in this slideshow.
Well, thank you.
So that'll be great. And some really good content. So that's wonderful. Well, we are going to take a quick break for the news. Here we have Fox News and local news coming up at the top of the hour. And then, Jesse, what do you have for us here in just a few minutes?
We're going to be talking a little bit about lawn weed control, since that is something that will be coming very important right about now. And we're also going to talk a little bit about tree appraisal and potentially determining the value of your own trees on your property.
All right. That's coming up here on the Mighty 690. 8:10 here on the Mighty 690, and we are back with Jesse Gilmore and Wendy Powell, K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. Welcome back. And Jesse, you have a timely topic for us this morning, as you know, people are starting to think about gardening and about lawn care, right?
Yep. So most people will have some kind of tall fescue lawn, or at least partially tall fescue, usually mixed with a warm season grass like Bermuda.
Bermuda, our favorite.
And so fescue, especially with how warm it's been in the last couple of days, will have started greening up a little bit by now.
Okay.
And with the greening up of fescue comes the growing of weeds. And henbit, in particular, is one weed that people are going to be struggling with.
We have
right
a really
now.
Nice patch of henbit right out front in the radio station.
Yeah,
right,
luckily
now
it's edible. You've got a nice crop of henbit.
So you can make like a salad out of it? Or
yep, it has a taste pretty similar to celery.
Really?
But that is...
Go get lunch.
Yeah, for real. I need something in my stomach. But for spring cool season weeds, you're going to want to put down some kind of pre-emergent herbicide. Pre-emergent herbicide goes a long way towards eliminating most of the weed control that you're going to need to do. It's kind of a set it and forget it type solution for lawn weeds. You could also put them in the garden, but depending on whether or not you want to grow seeds in your garden, it might not be a good idea to use pre-emergent herbicide.
And what would be like an example people might recognize, like a name for that?
Weed and Feed is often how this kind of thing is marketed in garden centers and hardware stores. The weed part refers to the herbicide, and the feed refers to a fertilizer. So it's a fertilizer mixed with a pre-emergent granular herbicide like pendimethalin. You just spread it, and as the nutrients dissolve into the soil, the chemical that makes up the pre-emergent herbicide will also dissolve into the soil. And it forms a chemical crust in the top half inch or so of the soil and scorches any seedlings that try to grow through it and basically kills them off before they can emerge, hence pre-emergent.
And is there a good time of year to, or maybe like, do you want to do that before a rain, or what's the kind of best time to spread that?
Right now, you usually don't want to spread any type of ag chemical before a rain in our area, because we can get such torrential downpours that it can run off and carry off the chemical.
You're just wasting
instead
money.
Of, yeah. And it causes, especially if fertilizer is running off, it causes problems with waterways.
Sure.
Things like algae blooms from too much nitrogen and phosphorus. So you would want to apply it on a drier day and then water it in manually. And it does not take very much to make sure that the fertilizer stay and the pre-emergent herbicide stay in one place. So you wouldn't necessarily need to soak your soil in order to make sure it gets in, because once it gets wet and starts dissolving, it's not going to run off as easily.
Gotcha.
So you could water it in a little bit and then wait for a rain, but that initial watering in needs to be done manually. So you can find pre-emergent herbicide pretty much at any garden center or hardware store. It's pretty easy to find. Usually it will be in those formulations with fertilizers. I would definitely not recommend buying one of those if you haven't had a soil sample done, though, because you might be applying unnecessary fertilizer. And in some soil samples I've gotten this year, you can actually introduce some potential toxicity if you've been fertilizing year after year after year with really high analysis fertilizers like urea. Nitrate in particular is one that you need to watch out for if you're going to fertilize with. I've had some nitrate, I think one soil sample had over 300 parts per million of nitrate. 30 is about what you need for a vegetable garden. Probably somewhere around 45 for lawns. So you don't want to over apply fertilizer if you can help it. And soil samples are one thing that the extension office does, pretty much every extension office. That's going to be true for Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Missouri as well, if you live in any of those listening areas. The soil sample process is a little bit different from university to university, but it will tell you a lot of the same things as far as nutrient levels go. So if you can, I would recommend just looking for a straight pre-emergent herbicide instead of a herbicide fertilizer mix, unless you know that you need that nutrient addition.
Gotcha. No, that's really good advice on that. What about bare patches, you know, that we have in lawns and that sort of thing? Are we still a little too early to start, you know, seeding those in, or what's the best advice on that?
So it depends on what grass you want to add. I know some people who absolutely despise Bermuda grass, and I know some people who love Bermuda grass.
It's very divisive grass.
Yeah, and it's almost always down to its ability to spread. Bermuda grass and zoysia, to a lesser extent, are running grasses, where they spread via modified stems, as opposed to bunching grasses like fescue, ryegrass, bluegrass, that basically stay in the spot where you plant them. So bare spots, usually I will recommend, if you have Bermuda grass already, putting in some plugs or sprigs of Bermuda grass. Bermuda grass is kind of weird as a turf grass in that it does not grow from seed as easily.
Oh, okay.
So you would either want to sod it. I would honestly never recommend sod for our area. Between the torrential downpours and the months and months of no rain in the summer, that's going to be a management nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
So sprigging is probably your best bet for Bermuda grass.
I know someone who spent like $900 for water to try to keep their sod alive last summer.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was a month.
I got called out to someone's house in Coffeyville asking about their sod. They're like, our sod is dying. And I'm like, oh, God, we have a complete and total loss of lawn, don't we? And I went, and they had only lost about 25 to 30% of their sod, which is way better than I was expecting.
Yeah.
I was totally expecting
just brown.
The worst.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they spent similar amounts of money on water for their sod, and last year was the worst time to be putting in sod. And obviously, they couldn't have known that before they got their sod in. It was just very unfortunate timing. So if you can not put sod in and find any other way to get a lawn established, do that. For bare patches, Bermuda grass would be my recommendation. Zoysia, a little bit less so. You're going to get better luck from seed with zoysia compared to Bermuda grass, but it also has a couple more drawbacks compared to Bermuda grass. It does not stay green as long. Staying green as long is the primary disadvantage to zoysia. But it is a nicer looking grass when it is green. For like the month and a half, 2 months that it is during the summer. For tall fescue, if you wanted to get tall fescue in that spot, we recommend putting turf grass in, or at least cool season grasses like fescue and rye, in September, because the temperatures are cooling down, but the soil is still warm, so it encourages the root growth on the turf. You get a little bit of thatch development without it being completely overwhelmed by thatch. You also lessen the risk of seed getting carried off by water. If if our rains were less torrential, there would be more merit to planting in the spring. And if bare spots are something you just can't tolerate, it might be worth trying. But I would not honestly hold my breath for those spots getting filled in early in the growing season.
Sure. Now, this is a little bit of a tangent, but last night I was watching one of those videos where they were showing the process of how they make holes for golf courses and everything. And I was watching and looking at the grass there, and it's just unbelievable. That's just like a different level. Is that fescue that they're using in golf courses, or like what is? I mean, because you know they cut it down to where it's like so short, it's insane. It doesn't even seem real.
No, for golf courses, there's two different types of grasses that they use between the fairway and the green. And it depends on the management of the particular golf course. But in general, in my experience with golf courses, the fairway is going to be some kind of thin, warm season grass like Bermuda grass.
Okay.
The green is going to be a cool season grass called creeping bent grass. Creeping bent grass is my favorite turf grass, but it is also the hardest to grow. It is so management intensive, and it will not survive our summers. That's more northeastern Kansas, where they can dedicate more water and where the summers don't get quite as hot as they do down here.
Sure.
It's an amazing feeling, turf grass. It's so soft. If you want a like really nice looking kind of lime green lawn with very fine looking turf grass as far as the thinness of the blades, creeping bent grass is the way to go. But know what you're committing to before going out and buying bent grass seed, because it will be a lot of work.
Yeah, it doesn't. In the pictures, it doesn't even look real. You know, it's amazing what they can do with that. So.
Yep, and they need that for golf courses. They need that softness on the green because they want to influence your shot as little as possible.
Well, sure.
Once you're there, fairways can be a bit rougher because you're swinging for the fences essentially when you're trying to drive all the way to the hole or at least to the green.
Yep.
So a little bit of different management based on the needs of that particular hole. So that goes a little bit into golf course management, which is not something I thought I'd be talking about today.
Well, you know, this is how we do it. So that's great. I love being able to ask you all these questions. So hey, anything else on you know, weed control, kind of lawn management that we need to be thinking about this time of year?
Not really. I, again, would recommend if you need a soil sample done. For fescue, your primary fertilization window for fescue, especially with nitrogen, is September, when you are potentially planting new fescue. There are secondary fertilization windows in November and May, so we are still a little ways out from fertilizing that. For warm season grass lawns like Bermuda or Zoysia, you don't want to fertilize until they are actively growing, because if they are not actively growing, the only thing that is going to be using the nutrients are the weeds that you don't want growing in your lawn. I am much more partial to weeds in my lawn than I think most people are, and that might be because most of my backyard is just nothing but weeds. There's literally no grass in there at all.
Wow.
You do have options for control of broadleaf weeds. The reason that things are often marketed as crabgrass preventers is because there are three classes of herbicides. There's non-selective, which will kill anything it touches. That's going to be spot spraying for problematic weeds, usually with something like Roundup. The second are grass-selective herbicides, which will kill only grasses while leaving broadleaf plants alive. And then there's broadleaf-selective herbicides, which will kill only broadleafs but leaves grass alive. And I could probably do an entire semester's worth of just the ways that herbicides kill plants, because there's about 18 different mechanisms of action for herbicides.
One that I saw, it was actually bleached. It like sucked the chlorophyll out of them.
Yep.
I was like, I hadn't seen that before, and it was wild.
Yeah, it'll bleach the leaves, and because it doesn't have the chlorophyll, it can't go through photosynthesis, and it basically starves the plant to death.
It was wild.
That is one mechanism of action. I believe that's just for broadleaves,
yeah,
but I might be
the
wrong.
The one I saw.
There's a lot of chemistry that goes into these chemicals. But for broadleaf selective herbicides, you can spray those on your yard and you will not have any issues with your turf grass, assuming that you are applying it at the rate given on the label or below. The problem with crabgrass is that it's a grass, and so is your grass. So you can't spray a grass selective herbicide on crabgrass and expect the turf grass that you want to survive to live through it. So that's why pre-emergent herbicide is often labeled as a crabgrass preventer, is because that is the one thing that you can't really spray for without potentially damaging your lawn as well.
Gotcha.
So you do have options for broadleaf selective herbicides if you're dealing with a lot of dandelions, usually, are what people are spraying for, and that makes me very sad because dandelions are my favorite plant. But 2,4-D triclopyr, I believe, is another common herbicide active ingredient. 2,4-D is the one I see most in lawns. You just need to make sure that when you are buying a product, that A, it is labeled for controlling the things you want to control, and B, that it is labeled for use on the crops. And it's weird to think about turf grass as a crop, but in this situation, it really
is. It is, yeah.
That it's labeled for use in the crops that you want to use it in. If the thing that you are trying to spray with your chemical is not on the label, that means that either A, was not tested on that particular weed and can't be proven effective, or B, it was tested on that particular weed and was proven ineffective. So you are basically buying a chemical to control a weed that the chemical cannot control. You're going to be throwing your money away at that point. The other thing you want to make sure of is that your crop, and I say crop again, it's still weird. It always will be weird thinking of turf grass as a crop. But you want to make sure that your crop is on the label, because that means that it was shown to have little to no injury to your desired plant at the rate on the label. And for some chemicals, different crops will have different rates that you can apply them at. So always read the label before applying any type of ag chemical.
Always a good idea.
We've got a saying in, well, it's not necessarily an extension saying, but the label is the law. So it basically has the same effect as law. And a lot of times that's for potential liability for damaged plants. In general, you want to keep your plants as healthy as possible. So understanding how much you can apply of a certain chemical will go a long way towards making sure that you keep the plants alive you want to keep alive and killing the plants you want to kill.
Absolutely. Now, as we, you know, we have the department stores and a lot of other places have their seed racks out. We've got the peat pots and everything in stock. So what are the things that we maybe should be thinking about starting indoors for gardening?
Indoors, well, really there's a lot of different plants you should be starting right now. And that's because you need to give the plants you want enough time to grow into seedlings if you did want to, you know, transplant them instead of just putting them straight into the ground. Tomatoes actually should go out around the end of May. So giving them about 8 weeks or so indoors is pretty standard. So the next week or so, you probably want to be starting your tomatoes indoors, assuming again that you want to do transplants.
Sure.
It is probably a little late to be doing most of the spring vegetables that you would need to transplant, because they should be getting in the ground in the next 2 to 3 weeks or so. Potatoes, onions, leaf vegetables, radishes, basically anything that is not eggplants, not tomatoes, not peppers. A lot of the fruiting vegetables are warm season vegetables, things like okra, squash. But assume it's decently safe to assume that if it's a root vegetable or if it's a leaf vegetable, that it is a cool season crop and should be going in pretty soon into your garden,
yes.
Not necessarily started indoors.
No, I don't think anyone wants to start radishes indoors. That would be odd.
Well, and the thing about radishes is that they are really fast.
Oh, yeah.
They are, I believe, the fastest in terms of from planting to harvest. Some radish varieties you can get in a month.
Yes.
From planting.
And so sometimes, you know, two people will stagger those plantings to where you just kind of get a continuous harvest throughout the spring.
Yep. But dealing with individual radishes
that
in
would be
pots,
bizarre.
That,
oh, my God.
That
gosh.
Would be very finicky. Oh. I can picture that being very finicky.
No, that'd be a large waste of time. Well, well, very good. That's always a good update, Jesse. And Wendy, do you want to hit one more time? Just a reminder on your class tonight for the people who just tuned in.
Yeah, absolutely. Animal Health Night. Doors open at 5:30 for the trade show. We've got a great list of vendors that are going to be there that support the program. So anybody's welcome to come to the trade show, but the program will start at 6:30. If you didn't have a chance to RSVP, then there probably won't be enough food for you, but you're still welcome to get the information.
Excellent. All right. Well, anything else? I mean, pretty comprehensive update, I'd say.
Yeah, thanks.
So, all righty. Well, Wendy, Jesse, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to chatting again soon.
All right.
Thank
sounds
you.
Good.
All right. We'll be back with an early bird edition of Open Line, and don't forget, we do have Candy Westbrook coming in at 9:10. That's all on the way here on KGGF.